You are now listening to Out of the Blank.
Welcome to another episode of Out of the Blank podcast. I'm here with Jill.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing all right, Jill. Jill, so I usually ask people, like, tell me a little bit about yourself. Tell me, I guess, what defines you? It seems like a better question.
Ooh, that's quite a difficult question to start with, isn't it? What defines me?
Because, like, you can say, like, your job, but that doesn't really accurately define who a person is.
No. And yet, if you say something like creativity, that sounds really pretentious. But I think that I'm happiest when I'm making something that wasn't there before.
Like a shelf or...
Well, do you know, it's like seeing the difference that you've made, isn't it? So maybe, you know, I do dressmaking, I do some drawing, I'm not very good at drawing, but even spending time in the garden and then you see something grow, and writing is the thing that I do, because otherwise life's kind of empty, isn't it?
To get the world thrives on creativity, and it's kind of been lost for so long. If we look at today's times, it seems like everyone either goes, it's already been created, or something like that. I'm like, no. What you're looking at has been created, but there's so many things that we don't even know 10, 15, 20 years from now that are going to be like, how did we ever live without it? Like, I don't think anybody remembers besides, I mean, these kids my age, on the factor of the cell phone. Like, nobody knows what that was like not to have one. I was at the cusp of that, and I'm like, there was a long time period where nobody even cared for a cell phone, nobody needed it. But then now it seems like, what will we do without it?
That's an interesting one, isn't it? Because obviously I lived the majority of my life without access to a cell phone. And I remember being offered one at work, because I traveled a lot, and I was offered a cell phone, very crude kind of thing. It was just a phone. And I remember thinking, I don't really want this, because if I've got this in my car, my boss can contact me anytime. And there's no way that I can sneak off and do my shopping in the afternoon if I know that she can call me anytime. So I kind of held off getting one. This sounds ridiculous now, doesn't it? And then my car broke down. I was driving an old car, and it broke down on a hill in the fog in Scotland, and I had to get a lift off a guy in a tacky Mini. And I remember thinking, this guy could be a serial rapist, but I've got to get a lift with him, because otherwise I'm not going to get my car fixed. And then I went into the office and I said, you know what, I think I will have that phone. Yeah, I think I'll just have it. But it was only a phone. It was just a phone.
It's good for emergency purposes. And it's weird as how the phone is transformed. If you look at, like, they had it in your car, and then people are like, wait a minute, I'm getting roaming charges like crazy. The fact, like, you're driving around with it and calling people. But, like, I really, like, before Twitter, before all these things came out, it's like the cell phone was used for emergencies. When you needed help in a situation, it was meant for that purpose. It was meant to be able to talk to people from long ago. Like, I have family that live super far away, so it's, like, easy to pick up the phone, call them, and have a good hour-long discussion with them. But then now it's just turned into, like, I'm stuck on Dragon City right now on my phone, where I just play and spend money on my phone. Like, there's no point to it. I don't know why I do it to myself, but it's there. And I'm like, the world of creativity really gets hurt when you look at a cell phone, because out of the amazing things we're able to do with it, most of the time we don't choose that avenue. We kind of, you know, use it and waste time on it a lot of times. We're on social media, which is good if you're promoting a business, but not when it comes to sitting down, drawing, trying to get in with your thoughts. And I mentioned to you, like, yesterday was a beautiful morning. Here it was probably like 55 degrees, so it had that little brisk chill. And I walked outside and I smelled the air, and I'm like, whoa, like you can smell fall, like it's getting ready for the leaves to change. And sitting out in that is a creative, I would say, manifestation maker. Like you're sitting out there and your thoughts are just coming at you and you're just thinking of so many different ideas. I could draw this, I could write this, I could do this, I could do that, or I could do this. And it's like, you literally have to go back inside to stop the flow.
I think you're right. And I think what we now call a phone isn't a phone at all, is it? How many people use this to make a phone call? How often do we use this to make a phone call? I'm talking to you from Scotland, you're in the US, and we're using something that's just called a phone. But we've got how many different applications for this thing? But the trouble is, we can just sit and be with it, connected to the internet, as you say, doing all sorts of waste of time stuff. Reading stuff that winds us up, especially nowadays, reading reports that, you know, somebody's written that has a particular point of view. We can go down all sorts of horrible rabbit holes if we're not careful and forget to go and sit in the garden, you know, or forget to talk to somebody or just have a conversation with somebody like we're doing now.
Yeah, it's hard. It seems like, oh, well, then I think it's Wi-Fi that's the problem. No, because you got data on your phone, and the next thing you know, you're out there getting charged up for something, or if you have unlimited data, you're still on the internet. It's all these apps. It's like,
yeah.
What, I guess, because you said you're creative, so where do you find that your creativity is attracted to the most? Is it writing? Is it drawing?
It's writing.
It's writing.
No, it's writing. Yeah, yeah. This is something that I've always done. And 3 years ago decided that I would kind of test myself to see whether or not what I write is any good. So I went back to university at 62 and took a master's degree at Glasgow University in creative writing, because I wanted to see if people who really knew about writing would value the way that I was writing, or to find a way, I suppose, that I could write that was acceptable to me as well as to critical thinking.
Kind of like
writers.
Somebody giving you like a funnel to be able to channel through some of your thoughts into a more, I guess, formed way that other people can understand them. Like, I feel like I definitely can, you know, I write poetry in my free time. A lot of people wouldn't admit that. It's kind of like a little secret passion of mine. But I write pretty good for someone that doesn't have any training or any understanding in it, really just kind of free flow of thoughts. But when you start talking to people that actually do it professionally and start realizing there's some things you need to fine tune. Now, I do have to ask, you know, going back to a university, how scary was that for you, thinking that, oh my God, I'm at this age and I'm going back to college? Like, because I look at that, I'm like, that has to be so weird. But my first college class, we had everybody, I was probably the youngest one in there. Everybody was like either in their 50s, their 40s, their 60s. And I'm like, oh, everybody's trying to get what society deems as you need this, which is a piece of paper letting you know that you went to a university or a college. And I'm like, let me tell you something. That doesn't mean anything in the grand scheme of things. I've met so many people that have blown my mind away that had an idea of going to college. Like some of the most amazing, kindest, nicest people. You know, it's the power of a person and their inhibition to want to do something is what I really like to see. You know, when you see someone that's mindlessly working and like hating their life, it's kind of upsetting. But when you see someone that's actually passionate about doing something, you're like, oh my God, like you found something that you love to do.
I think it was really scary. The idea of going back was fine, because I planned it in my head for a number of years, and I suppose I'd put it off. And once I made my mind up to do it, that was okay. But it was only when it got nearer the time that it seemed really scary. Like you, though, there was a range of ages in the group. And actually, one of my good friends that I met on the course is about 10 years older than I am, and she's a novelist. So, and there were people in their 40s and 50s and so on. And people were there for different reasons. So a lot of the younger people were there to make an academic career out of writing, to go on and do a doctorate and, you know, teach creative writing. But my goal was, I mean, it was great having the piece of paper. It was great to have that and to say, well, I've achieved this at 64, whatever. But it was more important that I achieved what I set out to achieve, which was that other people said, yes, this writing is, your writing is of a standard that's acceptable. So I could then, I don't know, it gave me confidence. It gave me confidence to go ahead with the stuff that I was writing and start to produce it as audio drama, which was what I'd wanted to do for a long, long time. So I suppose it's that idea that it's never too late. There's no point going around saying, oh, I wish I'd done this, and I could have been a writer, and I should have done that when I was 40 or 30. You just do it. Just get on and do it.
I'm jealous of the people that can write cursive, because cursive is like professionalism. They stopped teaching it when I was in kindergarten. Like, they stopped on like the letter Z. So I'm like, hold on a second, can we just finish this alphabet so I can? So my signature is like, it's scribble scrabble. But like, when I write it, I feel so confident. I'm like, oh my God, I'm a professional. Like, I can sign paychecks. I can sign anything I want. You want me to sign that for you? It's like, who are you? I'm like, sorry, I'm just practicing my signature. But audio drama. Now, this is something I really love, because for people that don't like to read a whole lot and like to listen to things, and also it's like movie for the blind, besides all like the fun descriptions of things. I mean, the audio drama is amazing. So I have to ask, what is the audio drama? Is it the time period? What is it about? Give me a quick like tutorial run through.
How is it done, do you mean?
Not like what is the audio drama, like what it's about, like what are you writing about, what is the story?
I write, okay. Well, I started off writing about people from history, people from French history, because I've got a passion for everything French. I learned French. I have a family in France that is kind of like my family, even though they're not technically my family. And so I've always, since I was about 12, loved things French.
I've had a croissant before.
Sorry?
I said, I've had a croissant before.
I'll send you some, shall I? Well, we can't go there at the moment. But so I took the life of the singer Edith Piaf, whose songs are just, oh God, full of sadness and full of real life, what real life is like, what love is really like, what sex is really like. And these songs were written in the 20s and 30s and 40s. And I took a part of her story and turned it into an audio drama, and had that produced and acted by some fantastic actors based here in Scotland. And then I went on to another character in French history, but a medieval character, and wrote a very dark play about a child murderer who was associated with Joan of Arc. So he went from being a French superhero in the Middle Ages to being burned as a witch and as a murderer. And that fascinated me, that kind of contradiction in someone's character. How did that work? So I think what you have to do is you have to take something that really you're passionate about, as you said earlier, and take a slice of that, which is what I've done in each case, because audio drama can't deal with war and peace in 1 hour or 50 minutes. You've got to take a small slice of what you're dealing with and really focus in on that and make that work. So what I do is look at the historical facts as we know them and read as much as I can around it, and then imagine what goes in the gaps. So imagine the conversations that lead up to these situations. Imagine the solution to the problem of how did this guy turn bad? What was the reason behind that? Nobody knows. So that's the space where your imagination, your creativity can really play and build something that is part fact and part fiction. And because of the resources that the audio drama has, we can create any scene we like at any time we like. We can go back into history, we can go into the future, we can do, you know, space odysseys, because we can do anything we like with the soundscape.
Yeah, it seems like for so long, when you read something about anything, at least through history, it's got to be, in 1979, this happened. And it's like, well, what led to that? I want to know, like, I love reading the journals of, like, historic, like, people that were involved in historical moments, like, stuff with the Holocaust. I loved reading those journals of the people that went through that. It was a terrible tragedy, but to hear a person's perspective of what someone had to go through really puts in the grand scheme of things of how important this moment was. What was that person going through? The fear of at any moment you could be captured, having to stay silent, making sure you didn't squeeze out a fart, anything. Where that impact, when you're reading it from someone that is dealing with that, you literally are putting yourself in their shoes. And with an audio drama, as much as you might add in a little bit of, you know, fiction mixed in with fact, it's a way of people understanding something through your eyes and your vision, but also maybe even encouraged to look it up for themselves. You know, what, who was this person? I mean, a child murderer. That's a big, like, impactful one that's going to draw. I mean, I was hooked as soon as you said it, but talking about it and then maybe adding some moments and stuff. What do you find the hardest with? You find it that it's like some of the stuff is like, you're really trying to give that person's perspective, or do you feel like you're not really trying to Hollywood it up a lot? Because I know we see a lot of movies on TV and stuff, and next thing you know, it's like, hold on a second, that didn't happen at all. What do you mean? Like, this is all added in just to make the film better. It's like, how hard is it for you to define that line?
For me, it's really important to keep it real, so that because it's a very intimate medium, isn't it? It's like reading a novel. There's you and there's the play. You're not in an audience. You're not in a theatre or a cinema. There's just you and the sound of the play. So I think it's really important to keep it real. So if you are having, say, Joan of Arc speaking to Gilles de Rais, who's the murderer, you don't want to pretend that you know how medieval people spoke in France in, you know, the 1400s, and start saying thee and thou and probably getting it wrong.
And then you can't have them drop like a, yo, we're going to invade this village over here. Where are you at?
That's right. Exactly. So how do you pitch that idiom so that the people still sound like real people and they come over as real people? In the first play, the one about Edith Piaf, I actually went a bit too far. And I use the F word quite a lot, which is okay, but then there's no way that the BBC are ever going to broadcast that play. And one or two competitions that I went in for went like, no swear words, no swear.
Hold on. If Quentin Tarantino can make Django, I'm pretty sure that you should be sponsored by BBC. Who cares if you say the F word?
But yeah, so it's the idiom. I think you've got to get that right. You've got to get the personality of all those people coming across just through their voice and just through the way that they speak.
Now, even with staying on the lines of fiction, how hard is it for you to not, I guess, to decipher the decision of, because you can add in anything with an audio drama. Like, I've wanted to start one up for so long just because, like, I love doing voices and I love kind of impressions and acting a little bit towards it. I think that's amazing how someone can capture literally where, like, you're listening to them. Being on screen is different. I mean, if you watch a movie, You see an actor, they really got to look the role. They got to, you know, you got to feel it. Everybody, when they're starting a series or something, sees a character on a screen, like, that's my character I'm going to choose throughout this whole entire series. And if he dies, we're going to riot. Like, you know, Daryl from The Walking Dead was a huge one. But when you're in an audio drama, you got to make sure that person's voice matches the description. It's got to be able to draw you in with such powerful words and their vocabulary. Where, like, I've been a few voices on a few audio dramas, and like, I'm given a script and I'm best at improv. So like, a script to me is like, oh God, here we go. And I'm reading it, I'm like, I don't feel like they would say this. I feel like it would be more like this. And then I send him my version. He's like, dude, you went out of the box with it. I love it. And I'm like, guess what I'm saying is, you got to get in the, you got to get the face of scrunches in. You got to add everything. You got to have the emotion in it. Like, you're got to put yourself in the shoes for it, just like you were if you were acting. But when you're writing something, it has to be on based on fact as well. You can blend in a little bit of details without messing with the big picture. But how hard is it for you to be like, I could easily turn this into a fantasy where this guy, the reason why he did this was because he had an inner voice leading into his head. And then that goes into a bigger description of maybe he was the devil, like the angel and devil on the shoulder. And it's like, oh, you can go so far with it, but then you start to lose track of the main essence of the story.
Yeah, I think it's really important that the story's got to be tight in audio drama. Apart from anything else, if the story isn't tight, then the audience is going to get confused. And as soon as they get confused, they're going to go make a cup of tea and you've lost them. So it's got to stay tight.
You said cup of tea. I'm like, hang on a second. Let's translate this for the Americans. Cup of coffee, a shot of Red Bull, anything of that sort.
Oh, no, it's definitely a cup of tea. So, yeah, no, it's got to be tight. And so I think there's got to be quite narrow parameters, unless you're making a whole series. Obviously, if you're making a series, space fiction or whatever it is really, then you've got much more scope to develop those fantasy ideas and, you know, move it into a different area. But if it's a one-off audio drama, then it's got to stay there. But what's interesting is something that you said about being an actor, voice actor, and we've just produced, we managed to do it during lockdown, just recorded a short play that's much lighter than the stuff that I've written before. And I think it's only fair for the writer to be tuned into the actors. So I'm working with mainly Scottish actors. I live in Scotland. You can tell from my voice probably that I'm English. I live in Scotland, but I'm mainly working with Scottish actors and sometimes with English actors as well. And I'm quite happy for someone to say to me, do you know, I wouldn't say that. This isn't how I would say that. Because I've got a foot in both, I've got an ear in both countries. I've got an English ear and a Scottish ear, and I don't always get it right. So I might write something that an elderly Scotsman wouldn't say. And so the elderly Scotsman that's playing the part in the play should be able to say to me, I think this would sound better. And I should be able to take that on board, unless I can justify perfectly well why it stays as it is.
See, that's an amazing connection, because like when I did that with my buddy, his name is Michael LaRusso, shout out to him. He does like this awesome cannibalistic, like Florida, what a description of Florida is, but it's like a radio show. So he's got little bits and commercials and segments in it. And I'm like tossing him out ideas and he writes out a full on script. And I was like, the first time I did it, I sent it to him and he goes, yeah, it's good, man. It's good. I was like, dude, can I just do it the way I'd like to do it? He goes, yeah, I want you to be you. I went like, I've been on the podcast. I know how you think. It's nothing's written down. So if you feel like I'm holding you down with anything, just do it like how you do it. I'm like, okay, that understanding is so important when it comes to something like this, because how many times somebody gets on a TV show or something and they're afraid to speak up because they're afraid they're going to lose it, or they're afraid someone's going to fire them. Like, you hear all these accounts of writers for giant TV shows that you end up changing one of their words or not giving them credit. Next thing you know, they write you off or kill you off in a TV series, then your whole lifeline or your whole goal of trying to be on a show is gone. I'm like, when you don't have that initial connection, when you, like, for me, if I was ever going to be an actor, I want to go to the writing room of where this story was. I want to see how this script was made. I want to see who are the people that I'm talking to that made this script. I want to define that relationship, and I want to understand who these people are so I can try and best envision of what I'm trying to do. And as like you're saying, you're giving out to some of these voice actors to say it, you know, that relationship is so important, because if they feel like they can't be creative with the role that they're given, then you're going to have a show that seems very, very drawn out, very, very, very fine-tuned and scripted, which you want it to be, but you want that era of creativity to flow. When you're listening to something like an audio drama, for instance, you have your headphones on, you're listening to a story being told. You can tell when it's like, here's where the narrator lines are written. Like when you're reading a play even, it has everything entering from stage left to, and they're describing the situation, which is important, but it's so robotic. It's like, where's that? And then there was a storm, and when the storm approached, and then there's this whole thing where like, oh my God, like, all right, we're leading up into it. You feel like, oh, he's not being chained to a desk right now and writing this out with a gun to his head. He's flowing. He's walking around the room trying to envision and say it how he thinks you would say it, but also with a bit of himself envisioned into the character.
Isn't that about one creative trusting other creatives to know their job? Because an actor is trained as an actor and knows her job. You know, a producer, so I, as you saw at the beginning, have very few technical skills at all. So when it comes to recording and soundscape design, that's the job of somebody else. But if you trust other creatives to do their job, then they come up with things that you couldn't possibly have imagined or envisioned. You can only go so far with your bit of that process. And you know, I'm just the writer. I love the writing bit. I love imagining what the soundscape would be, what the sound effects might be. But the producers that I work with have got much better ideas, because that's what they do. That's what they're trained to do. So if you try and control all of that and rein that in, you're actually stifling the creative process and saying, well, you know, I'm the only person who knows how to do this. I'm the only person who knows how to be creative. And it's the same with actors. If you might have thought that a line would sound one way, the actor says it another way, and you suddenly think, wow, that's so much better than the way I originally imagined it. So it's about trusting other people's creativity and not trying to keep that tight control of everything. Have you ever read a play by Bernard Shaw? Have you ever read a George Bernard Shaw play?
I think the only plays I've ever read were ones that were in school, like The Crucible and then Edgar Allan Poe and all these.
Arthur Miller and Edgar Allan Poe. Well, because I'm older than you, I had to read Bernard Shaw. We had to read Man and Superman and Major Barbara and things. And he was so keen that his plays would be produced in a certain way that the stage directions go on for page after page after page. He tells you what the actors should be wearing. He tells you where the furniture should be placed, you know, and everybody ignores it, of course, because that wasn't his job. He was a writer, not a director, and, you know, not an actor. There you go. You've got to let other people do their job.
It's so hard, though, because you have an envision in your head and you want it to turn out like this because you feel like that's the best to fit. Sometimes you got to let that creativity come in from somebody else where they can add it to the mix. That's when you see something truly work out, where it's like, wow, everything in this movie, everything in this thing came together because of the acting, came together because of the playwright, everything. Like, it's all a collaboration of things. I mean, you see a movie nowadays, most of it's CGI or technical stuff where they're just tossing like $1 billion at it. It's a bunch of explosions. And it's like, yeah, but the acting is shit. I mean, the character I didn't really believe anything he was saying. You barely showed him and on everything. That's where people have problems with movies. And it's like, you need to hammer out those details. You need to find the line and understand that what everybody is trying to envision with this role. And it makes me ask a question for you, which is, do you ever feel like you're born in the wrong time period? it seems like, yeah, this is a great way to funnel writing or playwright into a more, I guess, advanced society with using technology. But like writing plays, that is something that, like, I look at anybody that really writes an audio drama, like, oh, like, you might be born in the wrong time period. Like, there might be a period where you, like, are Edgar Allan Poe style or William Shakespeare, where you're, like, writing Macbeth, like, back when there's, like, pen and paper, you know, ink or something.
Yeah. I think I probably, if I'd started to take writing seriously earlier, then I probably would have written stage plays. I with a small group of people in Glasgow, set up a theatre group about, I don't know, maybe 15 years ago, can't remember exactly. And very, very small group. And we called ourselves Stark Theatre because we had no resources. We had no premises. We had no props, we had no money, and we did pop-up theatre. So we would borrow a basement room or an empty cafe, and we would put on our productions there. And we did that for almost a decade. So I didn't actually write anything for any of those pieces, but I was part of a team that improvised two of those plays. We did scripted stuff as well, but we started off by improvising characters and building them into something resembling a play. So I think if I'd started writing as a younger person, probably would have gone towards playwriting. But when I was writing the audio drama and I got my first rejection from the BBC.
Hold on, they rejected you?
They did. How dare they? I know. What cheek.
What did they say? What did they say that rejected you? Like, was it like, oh, there's too much language or something?
They said, well, apart from the bad language, no, they said that the scope of the piece was too broad. I was trying to fit too much into it, and they didn't think anyone would be interested in Edith Piaf anyway.
What? Have you seen anything the BBC has created? They have a guy talking about nature that has the worst, like, stutter or lisp or whatever, where he's like, the penguins on Twist Island. I'm like, how is that passed? That's the biggest problem. I mean, not to shame that guy, but good God.
Well, I'm so pleased that you're on my side. Anyway. My lovely children sent me a bouquet of flowers saying, congratulations on your first rejection and keep going, Mom, which was fantastic. But then my son said to me, look, he said, you're missing a trick here, Mom. Audio drama is being produced all the time and it's being podcast. And you can do that and you don't need to wait for the BBC to like or not like any of your stuff. So in a way, I'm born at the right time because this technology is there. You know, we can do this. We can even record plays. You know, you and I could record a play, you know, however many thousand miles apart, you and I could record a play and we could podcast it and people all over the world could listen to it. So in a way, I'm here at exactly the right time. Nice to have another 40 years to go, but, you know, I might not get that.
I'm honestly still stuck on BBC rejecting you, because I think that I'm so happy your son like tossed that out there, that like, hey, podcasting and thing, that's a, I mean, I, because at any moment, if he wouldn't have thought or if he wouldn't have said that, then you'd still be trying to send in letters to BBC, trying to keep getting your show written, and nobody would be able to see your content. And I'm like, one day, like, you're going to have, and it's an amazing feeling. I've had it happen too. When I first started, I reached out to some people that denied me, and then people reaching out like, hey, I've seen you've grown your following. BBC is going to do that with you. They're going to send you a letter. Hey, we've heard some of your stuff and we'd really like to have you aboard. And that's when you look at them like, where's the check? Where's the check?
That would be so good. That would be so good. When that happens, I'll let you know.
I would just ask if they could tell the guy who says wangwins or penguins on the BBC thing to actually spell it or say it properly, because that gets me so much. I know I'm not supposed to be like, you're Robbie, you're missing the big picture of things. It's Trash Island. I'm like, when he says on a field of wubble, I'm stuck on that. I want to know why that word is that. It doesn't, it loses me. You lose the initial focus of the idea, which is important, especially if you're making a documentary or if you're making a playwright. There's sometimes you see a word and you're reading it, you're like, we need to find a better one than that. There's got to be something like, here's a word of the day for you. Petrichor.
Okay.
I think it's the dew that is on the grass in the morning. It's called petrichor. So you toss that out and I was like, you toss that out. Let me tell you something. People's eyebrows go up. They go, man, he knows that's a word I've never heard before. And I'm like, see, even with vocabulary, when I go out into public using larger words, I know like it's so easy to be like, nah, I'm good. I'll pass, or being like kind of like just cut down slang. And yeah, it's faster, it's easier saying LOL than saying laugh out loud, but it goes into a bigger screen. Here's one for you. World Wide Web is faster than WWW, but everybody says WWW. I'm like, there's stuff in your language that you can hone in and focus on that makes you sound better, makes you sound more like a better form of etiquette. And I'm like, if you just use those, you'll start finding different avenues of where you can choose, I guess, where you want to go in life. I mean, doors will open up for you if someone hears you intelligently speaking. You don't even need a college diploma. But, you know, cutting down stuff, shortening words, and really kind of doing the English language, in my opinion, not you per se, but people, the factor of doing it a complete disservice. It's like I hear people talk sometimes. I'm like, whoa, hang on a second. It's not the mask that's the problem of why I can't hear what you said. Is I don't think you literally made a sentence that's intelligible for anybody to understand. Like that's where I see it all the time in public. I'm like, hang on a second. And I realize now, like growing up, all the times I was hit in the back of the head for saying, I would say the too fast. And then people would stop me, the. So I'm like, I got to get that word down. Obviously, it's important if somebody's correcting me and hitting me for it. So it's like, you need to get that down, because even if you're a writer, I can't spell Connecticut. I'll admit, I can't spell some words. Attention gives me pause at times. But then other stuff, it's like I'm writing it. I'm like, man, cross that out, because if you use too many its in a sentence, next thing you know, the whole thing gets lost, where it's like the it ran across it and it made it to the it other it. It's like, okay, let's refix this and let's use larger words where you don't have to use so many of those in there.
The English language is incredibly rich because it takes its words from so many sources. You know, so we had Anglo-Saxon, we had the Vikings, we had the Romans, then we had the French invasion, and you know, then we had waves of people coming in from other countries, a bit like the States, and all of that enriched the English language. So we have a huge number of words to play with, some of which we almost never hear, like petrichor, which I'll go and look up because I like it. But it's so easy to become lazy with language, and yet we have all these lovely words. You can find a word that is exactly right for the situation. Unlucky, because in Scotland they've got even more words, or at least they've got words that in England we don't have. So today, for example, if I look out of the window and I see a grey sky, and it might be raining but it might not, and the Scots would say it's a drich day. It's drich, which is a lovely word, isn't it?
Sounds like dreary.
It sounds like dreary. It sounds like kind of word, you know, but drich is, it just has a meaning all of its own. So in England we don't really have that word. We probably might say dreary or dull, or but it doesn't have quite the same subtlety of meaning. I think language is wonderful. I love playing with words.
I mean, I guess, well, I wouldn't say the praise is all on me for, you know, where I got kind of a long vocabulary. I have to say shout out to Word of the Day toilet paper. I learned a lot from that. And also as a kid, I like as like a little bit of like a punishment for not doing homework, I had someone sit me down at a table with a piece of paper and the dictionary and writing out a word and then a definition and do 10 of those a night. And next thing you know, you start finding out, like, I might sound intelligent or something like that. It's only because I'm replacing some simple words with larger words where it packs more of an impact. It's like people use curse language. I use curse languages to really hammer in something. It's like that has more of an impact than if you were like crap. You know, the word shit has a bigger impact to it. You can find that with your writing as well. Like when I'm typing, spell check aside, because I'll type so fast I'll make a mistake or something, but finding words that are able to describe better of what I'm really trying for you to see. And you know, even through some of the stuff I'm typing too fast where I need to reread it and stuff, but like I can talk pretty well, but when I type something or if I'm writing something or a story or something, besides maybe a couple run-on sentences and stuff, a lot of the times they're A+ papers. And I've never been that type of person to be able to do that, but it's a weird feeling you get when you get in that vibe where it's like, I'm just going to write for 10 minutes. And next thing you know, it's 10 hours later and you're like, holy crap. Like I just couldn't stop typing what I was envisioning. It just like it keeps flowing like an endless stream. And for people that don't write out there, really won't understand that unless you take the time to be able to do so. I mean, it's like starting anything that you kind of find a vibe or find a groove to, it takes a minute and then it all starts working. The brain gears start turning and you're like, okay, I'm now recognizing where I need to go with this. And how hard is that for you when you're writing something? Do you feel like, I need to set a day out for it? Or does the initial inspiration just come to you? Because I feel like even if it just came to you running it down, I feel like you'd still want to be like, I got to finish this. It's like, hey, the house is on fire. You need to get out. Like, hold on, let me just get this sentence in and we'll do this. And it's like, I don't think you understand a fire means that that's not going to wait for you at all.
It's interesting because this is one of the things that I found out about myself through doing a course, which meant that I had to meet deadlines. Okay. If somebody gives me a deadline, then I will meet that deadline. I'll stay up all night if I have to, but I'll meet that deadline. But if nobody gives me a deadline, I will put it off and put it off for probably weeks. And so my difficulty with writing is getting started. And what you said about the brain gears turning, the hardest thing for me is to sit down and start something because I don't have usually the whole thing planned out in my head. Some writers do, some writers know exactly where that plot's going to go, and I don't. So I will perhaps start with, you know, the germ of an idea that this is an interesting bit of this person's history. As I talk to you about my plays, this is an interesting nugget of information, but I don't really quite know what I'm going to do with it. And so it's only when I have my hands on the keyboard and start typing the words that the words start to flow, if that makes sense. Then they're not really going through my head until I start writing them. So actually starting is quite difficult because it feels like there isn't anything there. There's nothing to come out, so you put off doing it and you go and do something else instead. I do set time aside and I do try and stick to that. I can't write full time at the moment because I've got other things going on. But once I get going, you're exactly right. Once it starts to come, then your brain is tuned into it. Then you're thinking about it all the time. And then, you know, someone says your dinner's ready and you go, no, just wait. I've got to finish this first.
Next thing you know, it's cold.
Yeah, that's fine. House is on fire, dinner's cold, but just let me save this before I lose it.
Look, you're not having a good day at that point.
But the other thing is getting up in the middle of the night, isn't it? Is waking up in the night and thinking, oh, but so-and-so needs to say this, or I've just thought of something that will work that whole plot out beautifully. And if I go back to sleep now, I'll never remember it in the morning. So I've got to get up and I've got to write that down. That's the worst.
So about probably 2 years ago, almost 2 years ago, around the time when this podcast was first starting out, I was in college and I was taking an art appreciation class. And this is a few regrets I have on it. One, the project was that we had to go to a museum and everybody was going on a field trip to go to this museum. Well, it was like 4 hours away. And I'm like, all right, I don't really want to go to that. I just don't feel like traveling that far. So I'm going to say I'm going to go on my own terms, which is like, if you have a car or something, you just drive to whatever museum, art history museum, whatever. So I looked up one on the internet, which was close to where I lived. This is where I say I regret it, because I was like, I missed out on the experience of a lifetime to go to an actual art museum 4 hours away and be able to really take in the art. But I Googled one, saw a bunch of pictures on the internet, and I was like, all right, well, I'm going to say I went with my mom. And next thing you know, I start typing out this thing, and I started getting so into it where I was like talking about how that, like, look, further examination of an art piece that was on the wall. And I found a specific name of one that was in this actual museum, and I named it, you know, and I said, as I kind of approached closer to it and looked at the canvas brush paintings and the strokes of seeing which direction the artist was kind of doing that, I envisioned in my head what that artist was going through. And I said, I used so much large words where for me, I'm like, I bullshitted through this thing. But anybody listening to it was like even I read it off to my mom and she was like, when did we go to this? And I'm like, it's the idea. I made it up. Like, she's, you should be a writer. And I'm like, no, it's just, I really am good at kind of like finding a flow. And when I get in that flow, it gets going. Next thing I know, I turned the paper and I'm like, yo, I hope he doesn't want proof, man, cause I don't have any proof to explain all this. Next day he's like, I got a paper from a student. I'm going to read it off, cause I really enjoyed reading this. And he starts reading it. And I took a video on my phone because I'm sitting down on my phone playing Dragon City. I will admit it's been years I've been dealing with this curse of Dragon City, but he starts reading it and I'm like, hold on a second. That's my play. Like that's my story. That's my experience of visiting that museum, which didn't actually happen. I was sitting on my bed watching Netflix, you know, typing on my computer. And I start hearing it. I'm like, no way. So I took a video of it. And I'm like, teacher read my thing. He's like, this student did an amazing job. And, you know, he didn't ask me to stand up in front of the class and claim it or anything, but he goes, I just want to let you know, this is a perfect example. And he uses it now for I hope he doesn't listen, because that would suck if he stopped.
But I hope he's not.
It was that experience where I got into a flow that I was typing. And I mean, page after page was just coming to me. And I was just, you know, I was just going. I didn't know what I was going to talk about. I was just looking at a few paintings online and kind of see the angle of like with the actual building is like, let me take a little tutorial of a walkthrough of this place. I see the hardwood floors, which I feel like set a better ambiance for the paintings that were hanging on the wall on a white coated wall, like going in very descriptive in detail. Those little slight adjustments and stuff are so crucial in writing that you wouldn't even think. A lot of people are like, well, get to the point. It's like, hang on a second. That's like a buildup. You need that buildup to get to the actual main thing. And depending on whatever you're writing about, it could be paintings, it could be visiting a museum, it could be visiting the biggest ball of twine. Having that experience really can impact a story, where a lot of people say that thing was terrible, that wasn't that good. That's one of the crucial details that get missed out, is the fact that you didn't add enough detail to it, but you don't want to oversaturate it too. So with this weird ebb and flow, where I'm looking at people that are writing something and it's like New York Times best number one seller. I'm like, every book is a number one seller. Who's judging this thing? Like, I want to read it for myself. And if I'm not in tuned after the first 10 pages or something, then you need to find that vibe, just like any book, anything you're passionate about. You're going to be passionate about something to do with French history if you're reading it. For me, I'm going to be passionate about something completely different. And you need that to draw you into something. And that is one of the most important and one of the hardest things to do as a writer, is to be able to capture somebody's attention when they didn't pay a ticket fee and they're not looking at something. Being able to hear it or being able to read it is something that is probably the hardest for today's minds to be able to consume, but it can be done.
Isn't it interesting though, because for quite a long time, certainly here, I don't know about the States, but Radio 4 is our BBC channel that deals with news and
we don't talk about the BBC here.
We don't talk about the BBC, but and so every day there is a play on Radio 4 in the afternoon at, I don't know, 2 o'clock. And for a long time, it was considered to be the kind of the old fashioned way, the old fashioned medium, right? So my dad, who became blind in his later years, always listened to the radio and particularly to the afternoon play. And some suited him and some didn't. Some were more experimental than others, but it was kind of an older person's medium. So what really interests me now is the rise of audio drama as if you like, almost a new medium. So people are rediscovering it for themselves through podcasting, through, you know, some of the amazing stuff that's out there, to any taste, really, to any age group, to any, you know, passionate interest. There is something out there for people in a medium that was starting to look like it was finished, it was done with, because we had film, we had video, you know, we had Netflix, we had all of that. So why on earth would you need the old-fashioned radio? And yet audio has come back into its own, which I think is fantastic, because I always loved it anyway.
Would you say that's one of the draws also when you're creating one of these audio dramas, is that the fact of, like, your dad went blind, and it's also something like that, that's kind of a little bit of a, seems like a connection there.
Yes, I think it is, because you realize then just how important it is. He went blind, so as an older person, so it was probably more difficult for him to adapt to that than it might have been for someone younger. And the radio was crucial to his life. Not just the drama, but the drama was a really important part of it. And in my mind, I suppose, when I am writing audio drama, exactly, you said at the very beginning, you know, these are movies for the blind. We're creating something that you don't need.
It seemed like a bad joke now that I know your dad was blind.
No, it's not. No, it's not, because it's absolutely right. And it definitely it struck a chord with me, because it, someone who can't see has as much access to an audio drama as anyone else, which is fantastic. And that we're painting a picture. So the soundscape people that I mentioned before, who are, you know, just a huge part of the team that I work with, you know, it's like they're painting a picture in color for people who either can't see or want to be doing something else. You know, you want to be cooking or ironing or gardening, you can still be listening to this other world that's coming right in through your headphones.
You know, like basically like an escape, like much like people play games or a movie or something, it's an escape there. You want to feel like you're having something in your head going on where you can envision and let your fantasy take place. Because how many times do people stay up in their head anymore? Most of the people in the world, you know, everything's like they're missing out on crucial details of thing. And like I told you in the beginning, sitting out on my porch and just kind of smelling that air. Any other day, if I had work, you know, later in the day, or if I had to do errands or something, I would not have even taken a second to even smell that air and even notice that detail. I would have just done it without even thinking about it. That's the stuff that's crucial in life. Listen to your heartbeat in your chest. That is something. Listen to your voice. Like if I'm talking, I'm listening to it bounce and feel through my bones. You know, these types of things that we neglect on, or most people neglect on an everyday basis. And it's like, just literally stop and smell the roses. Literally stop and just take it in and understand that, yeah, you have something in an hour, or you have something you feel like you need to do right now. But at any moment, it can wait. Unless you got your kids at school, don't make them wait, you know, pick them up. But like any moment, like life is this amazing thing that we're supposed to literally sip and enjoy. And a lot of that gets lost. I get at fault for doing it myself, for trying to do as many things as possible. But really taking in a lot of things, you start to realize that time's a lot longer than it looks. Like people think, oh, it's over in a minute. It's like, it's over in a minute because you don't remember most of it, because most of it's spent on your phone. But if you really sit there and you like enjoy what's going on around you, I can feel those seconds pass. Like, it feels like, oh my God, I feel like I've been out here for an hour. How long have I been out here? 5 minutes? Holy crap. That's not that you're not having fun. That's that you're really taking it all in.
It's probably more important than ever at the moment with, you know, the world in a state of disarray and people's lives, then normal activities being confined, as we are in Scotland at the moment, we're quite confined. So it's more important than ever, rather than worrying about what's going to happen or thinking about what we might be missing out on, is just to say, well, you know, here I am, I'm in my garden, you know, the birds are coming down to peck at the seeds, or, and the leaves are turning brown, and I'm just here right now and everything's okay. And I think perhaps people are doing that more, or perhaps their anxiety is getting in the way. I'm not sure.
You'd think if you're in the garden, your anxiety would go away.
Mine does.
I don't know. I gave myself a panic attack the other day. I like to do that from time to time. I like to push the boundary of my anxiety and see how far I can really go with it. Like I said, if you start examining things like that, like I started thinking about my heart. Next thing I was thinking about the little ventricle that I would see in like, and I started thinking about the blood going through that. Next thing I know, I'm laying out in my driveway and everyone's walking by. Are you okay? I'm like, I'll be fine.
That's the opposite of mindfulness. It must be, surely.
Well, hey, Jill, I really appreciate you for giving me your time and coming onto the podcast. Please, can you promote where people can find the audio drama, where they can find you, contact you, anything that you want to promote?
Yeah, sure. I've really enjoyed this. This has been just a lovely, lovely chat, Robbie. Honestly, it's been great. My website is, I won't say www, will I? It's Jill Korn. Jill Korn, that's JILLKORN.com. So if you go on there, you click on audio drama. In fact, I think they're on the front page. You can just stream the audio dramas from there. There are two at the moment. There are two more in production, which are also, they're very different. The two that are in production are very Scottish. So you'll have France on the one hand and Scotland on the other. And I hope you enjoy them.
I'll make sure I link everything in the description. And thank you for listening to this episode of Out of the Blank Podcast. And stay tuned for our next episode.
Hey, thanks for checking out the podcast. If you want to visit iTunes or Apple Podcasts or anywhere you get your podcast, rate, review, subscribe, and even share the show. Helps me out. Leave me a little something, like a little message about oregano or Domino's pizza or how Papa John's is evil. Thanks for checking out Out of the Blank Podcast.